Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we sit down with Lauren Wolk, an award-winning poet, artist, and author. Her new book is My Own Lightning. She's also the author of Echo Mountain, Beyond the Bright Sea, and the Newbery Honor winner, Wolf Hollow. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks. Hi, Mindy.
All right, so this new book is actually the sequel to Wolf Hollow.
Yes, it is.
Sequels can be tricky.
Yes, they are.
And I read that you were warned about the challenges of a sequel, and maybe it wouldn't be such a great idea. So why did you decide to go against that advice and do this?
Oh, that's a very good question. And it's a complicated answer. I'll try and make it brief. I don't know, first of all.
I'm glad you did, by the way.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I loved writing Wolf Hollow. It was such a pleasure to write that book. And it was so much about my family and our history, people I love, a place I love, that I just felt immersed in a very safe and wonderful place. So, you know, when the world went crazy, or crazier, several years ago, and then the pandemic came, it made it crazier still. I think I really wanted to retreat to a place where I felt safe and comfortable with people I understood. But I was also very curious about what Annabelle, my protagonist, would do with her life in the wake of things that had happened to her during the first book, what she would do, what would happen to her and because of her. And it was my therapy for dealing mm-hmm. with a lot of things, and my chance to explore some things I was feeling as a result of the bombardment of negativity that was coming at all of us. So I kind of slipped into her skin again, and we went on a fresh adventure.
Yeah. And so you wrote this during the pandemic then?
I did. It's hard to remember exactly when I started it, but I think it was right before. Yeah, it was right before. In fact, right before the pandemic started, like maybe March of 2020, and just before Echo Mountain came out. And it took a while because I was so distracted.
Right.
Everybody
was.
Things.
Right.
Yeah.
And I love how you say you wanted to know what happened to Annabelle in the wake of Wolf Hollow. And this, I talk about this with authors, and I've talked about this with you before. These characters kind of take on, you don't know, even though you're the person writing the story, sometimes these characters go off in directions that you're not expecting.
Yeah, I never write with a map. I never want to know what's going to happen. And I trust my characters enough to live their lives. And then I just, you know.
You follow along.
I go with them, right. And sometimes we get a little lost on the way without a map, but we always find our way back.
Yeah. All right, so the story starts off with Annabelle helping her brother look for his lost dog, which, come to find out, isn't the only dog that's missing. So this is a big part of the story.
Dogs.
Yeah, dogs.
Yeah. I don't have pets. I really never have. My husband's allergic to everything. When I was a kid, we had cats. But I love dogs, and I've known a lot of dogs. And I don't know. They always find their way into my books.
All right. So this really also is a story of Annabelle and Andy. And people may remember Andy was one of the bullies from Wolf Hollow. Mm-hmm. So did you have this idea of second chances in mind when you wrote this book, or did it just sort of unfold as the story went along?
I think it was a little of both. It's sort of like what happens to Annabelle. There's an external influence and an internal, you know, rising of awareness of who she is and what she wants out of life. And that was happening to me, too. So much on the outside going on and my internal life reacting to that. And so the Andy angle, this book originally had many more subplots, but he was the thing. He was the one who ended up just speaking the loudest and calling attention to himself. And the relationship they have together, Annabelle and Andy, and how it develops all became the heart and soul of the book. And so other things fell away. But, you know, I wasn't sure really what was going to happen between them, except it was really important to me in my life to give people second chances, take a much closer look at people I thought I knew, was learning new things about. And so that opened the door to further discovery. And right. I think that's really important that we be empathetic and inquisitive about each other.
It's been a while since I read Wolf Hollow. What, the 2016, I think that came out?
It
is that
did.
Right? So when I picked this book up, I'm thinking, okay, I don't really remember.
Yeah,
but I love how you weaved in these little hints, and I'd have these flashbacks in my mind. I'm like, oh yeah, now I'm remembering. So you really you don't have to go back and reread Wolf Hollow if you've read it once already, because you give us some hints along the way. Was that difficult on like how to weave that in without you know, rehashing the whole book?
It was. I was more concerned about people who had not read Wolf Hollow and who would might be picking this up, because the first chapter is full of spoilers. So I really hope that people will read Wolf Hollow first. Although I do believe this book stands on its own.
It does, yeah.
But you don't have to read Wolf Hollow again first. I've heard from many, many people who have, and then they've gone straight into My Own Lightning, which is maybe a pretty satisfying experience, but you don't have to do it that way.
No. Do you want to read a little bit for us?
Sure. I won't read that chapter one with all the spoilers. I will read the beginning of chapter two, which in some ways is really the beginning of the book. By the time I had climbed up out of Wolf Hollow to where the woods ended, the storm had come stomping out of the west in its big black boots, gnashing its teeth and shouting itself hoarse, and I realized that I shouldn't have ignored the maple leaves that had flashed their white warnings, or the wind as it had suddenly blown cold against my bare arms. But I had ignored them, and now I was caught unprepared, without so much as a hat on my head. I knew about storms. I knew not to stand under a tree. I knew to stay away from anything metal, anything tall. I knew that if I could hear thunder, I was within reach of lightning. But I was nearly home, with no shelter to be had, and the thought of lying flat on the ground to wait out the worst of it seemed idiotic. So I hurried on just as the storm pulled a fistful of cold, wet marbles from its pocket and flung them against my face. In the space of a moment, I was drenched, heavy with rain, torn between wanting the shelter of the trees and knowing I should leave them. It was the lightning itself that made me run, though I crouched at every white flash, as if the storm were taking my picture, and then raced on, fast as I could. When I reached the crest of the hill, where the lane waited to take me, to lead me down again toward home, I paused, shocked at the sight of the hemlocks along the lane, thrashing and twisting like they were trying to pull up their roots and run. I stood there, rigid with fear, when suddenly the air fizzed around me, as if I'd been dipped in wasps. In an instant, those wasps stung me all at once, every inch of me, inside and out, and I knew nothing at all except a sizzling pain in my head, a dreadful heat, a sharp emptiness in my chest, and a kind of ending.
Mm-hmm. So Annabelle's struck by lightning there.
Yes.
Now, I'm assuming you have not been struck by lightning. So how did you figure out what that would feel like? Did you go look at accounts of people who had been struck by lightning?
I did. I've been metaphorically struck by lightning, but never physically. And I have to hand it to NPR, to this station, actually, because around the time when I was beginning to think about this book, I heard a story about a man who was struck by lightning and then sort of recovered and was able to play the piano and to compose music. And it became the center of his life. And I began to investigate when I decided this might happen to Annabelle. And I found stories about people who recovered from lightning strikes and were able to do complex mathematics or speak other languages. And I find that endlessly interesting, not only because of the stories themselves, but because they suggest such untapped potential in our brains, so much waiting to be discovered.
Yeah. And Annabelle does acquire a special gift.
She does.
Not playing the piano, though.
Originally I had her with more than one gift.
Oh.
And then my editor and I decided, let's just stick to one.
Yeah. Let's talk about Annabelle for a minute. She is inspired by your mom, right? Somewhat by your mom, somewhat mm-hmm. by you. And you mentioned that during the pandemic, you wanted to go back to a place you knew. And this is based on your mother's family farm in Pennsylvania, right?
Right. So, and where I spent a lot of time growing up, too. So the farm's been in the family for centuries. And she, of course, grew up there. Her stories about her childhood there really inspired the original Wolf Hollow, even though I wrote a work of fiction. The inspiration was definitely her stories and my mother herself, my grandparents, my uncles, and my time there. It's a small farm, couple hundred acres, but it's really the taproot of my family and of me in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Your books take on some heavy issues like bullying, loneliness, doing the right thing. Why and what has been the reaction from younger readers?
That's a good question. I have had kids come up to me and say, thank you for giving us a book that required us to really think and respond. You know, these are serious books, There's some levity in them, and I hope they're interesting, and there's a bit of mystery in them. But they are about serious topics, and I think kids like the fact that I respect them enough to trust them with weighty things. And I believe it's important that kids be exposed to serious issues. They're certainly exposed to everything else in the world, because they're at a point in their lives where they have to figure out how to navigate the world and how to deal with those issues in their own lives. So I don't see anything wrong with telling them the truth.
Yeah. I recall when Wolf Hollow came out thinking that this is not a young adult book. This is an adult. And I remember we had this conversation where you said, yeah, I wrote it for an adult. Mm-hmm. And I think it was your publisher who said, yeah, no, we're going to put this in the young adult category. Has it surprised you that Wolf Hollow and your other books, for that matter, they're in this young adult category, but they are really for any age? And I know you've had fans of your books of all ages, right?
When I do a reading, it's usually a mixture of, well, the ages range from, you know, 6 to 86. And I love that. And I've had letters and conversations with people that describe how a grandparent might buy Wolf Hollow and read it herself before giving it to her grandchild, and then handing it down to her daughter or son. And they read it, and then they pass it down. So it's three generations. And then they have these wonderful kitchen table conversations about the issues and the characters. And that's the absolute best thing I could ever hope for. Yeah. So although I write for middle grade, young adult, I definitely just write for myself and for a reader. Mm-hmm. But these are coming of age stories, so they're perfect for kids.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because, you know, you're 13 years old and you read this book. You're like with Wolf Hollow, I thought, wow, there's some stuff here that at that age they might not get. Right. And they might not. But then they go back and read it a few years later, or you're an adult reading it, you're taking away a different perspective. That is quite a talent, Lauren, to be able to speak to these different, you know, age groups with, you know, this, like I say, weighty stuff.
Well, I'm a 12-year-old girl inside. I really am. I think that was the age where I found my true self. And there's a lot of me that's still 12 years old. And then there's a lot of me that's 62 years old and everything in between. So I think all of that goes into everything I write. I'm sure that's true of all writers, that everything you've ever experienced goes into your work.
Yeah. All right. So the story takes place in the 1940s, but there's this timeless quality about it. Talk a little bit about that and why the 1940s?
Well, my mother's childhood set in the 1940s, and since her stories inspired Wolf Hollow, it made sense to set the book there. And I write historical fiction, so I haven't written a book recently that took place after the 1940s, some of them quite a bit before that. But I believe there are universal themes in my books that are as relevant today as they were then. But also I rely very heavily on universal languages to communicate, those being the senses and the emotions. So, you know, if that maybe that contributes to the timelessness of them, that the way a mountain looks or a coyote sounds in the night, or how it feels to be in a peach orchard picking peaches, or to deal with serious problems like bullying and loneliness, those are all timeless.
Yeah. I also wonder, is there something to the simplicity of the time as well? I'm thinking if you set that, you could make it present day and still do that, but you'd have to include social media and, you know, like all the other things, the technology and what we have.
Yeah.
So is there something about the simplicity of the time that helps you with whatever message you're trying to convey?
It does, and that's well put, Mindy. The simplicity of life on a farm in the 1940s, but that juxtaposed against the very complicated world issues, World War II going on, all of that made it fairly easy to talk about to write about the issues and to have the characters grappling with them without a lot of the distractions of the modern world. I sat down to try and write a book set in modern times in an urban setting, and I was overwhelmed by how much I felt I had to include in order to set the stage properly. And it wasn't anywhere I really particularly wanted to be.
Mm. We're talking with Lauren Wolk. Her new book is My Own Lightning. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with author Lauren Wolk about her book, My Own Lightning. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so there are three generations living in Annabelle's household, which is probably more common in the 1940s than nowadays, right? So tell us a little bit about her family.
Yeah, that My mother used to tell stories about how it was her grandparents, her parents, her aunts, two aunts and an uncle, and her brothers and herself all living in this farmhouse together. And it made for some real, you know, there were demands, especially on my grandmother who had to cook for them all. But it was also wonderful to have that extended family under one roof. And so that was something I decided was very important in these books, because Annabelle learns from all of them in different ways. And she has very strong relationships with all of them in different ways. And I think all of that contributes to the fact that she's a pretty mature, empathetic person with an interesting perspective on life.
Mm. And some interesting dinner conversations, right? Because they were all eating around the table for the meals. And tell us a little bit about Aunt Lily.
Aunt Lily is based on my Aunt Molly, who I grew up with, and she had a great love of books, and she used to actually take us into her little back bedroom where she lived and play Peter and the Wolf on the phonograph, and so there were some pleasant times, but she was an incredibly bitter, acidic, angry woman who took that out on all of us, and she was just righteous, and so, she was a pill, a hard pill to swallow.
And that's Aunt Lily.
Yes, and that's Aunt Lily. So she's a character who's very true to her real-life inspiration.
All right. So Andy, we mentioned, is a bully. But we see the softer side of Andy in the story, and you can't help but feel bad for his home life. Talk about your thought process and how to show these different sides of Andy, but not let us forget that Andy's a bully and done some bad things.
He has been a bully. He's done some bad things. He's done fewer bad things than people assumed he'd done. And so that's one reason he deserves a second look. But his background is diametrically opposed to Annabelle's. His family, the way they treat each other, everything about his life is the mirror image of Annabelle's. And I wanted Annabelle in this book, or not so much wanted her to. She simply did go on a journey of discovery about him, but also about herself and how lucky she is, how much she has. She learns to count her blessings even more than she ever did, partly because she watches him and she sees what his life is like. So that's all very important.
Mm. Our first impressions of some of the characters may be different than who they really are. And it makes me think of, you know, the old adage, don't judge a book by its cover, right? So what were you trying to say about judgment?
That we rush to it too often, that there's a real price for tribalism and for not looking very, very closely at each other, not giving each other second chances, making assumptions, all of it. It's natural, and sometimes we don't have the opportunity to look more deeply into other people. But I've made the mistake often in my life of assuming things and judging people and listening to what other people say about people and trusting that. Those are all mistakes. So I wanted Annabelle to both make them and then learn from them and then go forward different.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if some of what's going on in current day was influencing that, because we've all had that experience, right? Where we're learning things about people that we didn't know, you know, with all the conversations on Facebook, some of it good, some of it not so good, going, wow, I didn't know this person thought that way. Or just the judgments, again, that we're seeing so much of. Did that, it was what happening now influence all of that?
Very, very much so. Yes. And so I would say that although the pandemic was a terrible thing, and I wish it had never occurred, it opened my eyes in new ways. And as did many other things, the social justice movement, the what's going on in politics, what's going on in the whole world and has been for years, forever, really. That all influenced me a lot as I was writing this book.
Talk a little bit about Annabelle's instinct. You know, you're looking people, and she plays off of, like, I'm thinking her mother, like sometimes, you know, or her dad, how they react to a situation does influence Annabelle's instincts about things.
Sure. And we all have instincts, and, you know, there's the nature and nurture combo. And she has very strong parents, very good parents, who trust her to make her own decisions, but also recognize that she's a young girl and she needs guidance. So they give it to her. Then they kind of let her decide what to do with it, which leads to a pretty interesting path forward for her. She is a little secretive. She likes to handle things on her own. She certainly did in the first book, and maybe a little less so in this one because she's been burned by that. Mm. And she's learned her lesson about not knowing everything she needs to know before she can do something that's risky. And so kids ask me, you know, do you think it's okay to lie? Do you think it's really, you know, it seems like you think it's okay to lie. And I said, well, sometimes it's what you do because you think it's the best reaction to a situation, but you need to be pretty careful and be very thoughtful about what you're doing, or you could end up in trouble.
Yeah. So you do a lot of interactions with kids at school groups, right?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. And what is that like? I mean,
it's interesting. It's really, really interesting. And it's always very fulfilling. Kids are brilliant. They're so smart. They're so perceptive. They're so curious, insightful. They ask the best questions. And I often say, well, what do you think, when they ask a really good question? Mm. And they come up with wonderful answers themselves. So it's really gratifying. I wouldn't trade writing for young people for the world. I was a little shocked at first when my agent said, you know, We'll Follow is a middle grade book. I was like, what are you talking about? Because my, you know, it was a paradigm shift. I had to see the world in a new way. But I am very happy where I am.
Yeah. All right. So when you wrote Wolf Hollow, I remember you telling me that you wrote it in 3 months and you're a fast writer. You also said if you weren't working, you could probably write a book in a month.
All right. Did I say that?
You did. I went back and listened to the interview. You're retired now. So is that what you're finding?
No, the opposite. I, you know, they say if you want something done, ask a busy person. Because, you know, when you're that busy, and I was, it was a 70-hour a week job for many years when I worked at the Cultural Center. And on top of that, raising kids and doing all kinds of other things with my family and writing. I just had to cram in every single spare moment I had, usually at 5 a.m, write as fast as I could, and then the rest of the day think about it. So when I sat down to write, it just came gushing out. Well, now I have a little more time, although not as much as I thought I would. And so I've slowed down. Mm-hmm. Plus, the publishing industry is like molasses. So I can rush to get a book out because it wants to be born. And then it's going to sit there for a long time and wait its turn, which is good because I take a rest and I go back and rewrite it. But really, my speed does not match the speed of the industry. So I can afford to slow down a little.
Yeah. Now, you're also a painter, a poet, as I mentioned. So do you find that you have... put on these different hats? I mean, are you going, okay, well, today I'm going to write, tomorrow I'm going to paint, and you know, now that you've got this time, how do you work it all in?
I wouldn't call myself a painter. I'm horrible, but I'm an assemblage artist. And so my basement is full of items I found in my travels waiting to be worked into mixed media and assemblage art. And they haunt me. They call me from the basement with their little voices. And I love making art. It's very therapeutic and rewarding. And it puts me in the company of other people who are artists. And so it's all good. But lately, it's really been about the written word, than ever, and all kinds of new projects that involve writing and book travel. So that's consumed me. But I hope to spend the summer doing a mixture of things.
So have you found that your process has changed at all? I mean, you said you were cramming at 5 a.m. in the morning, and now you've got this other time. So when you're writing or how you're writing, is that all changed, or is it still similar?
Well, I'm working on a screenplay with my son, and he is a night owl, and I'm a morning person. So I have found myself working a bit more at night, and it does not come naturally to me at all. I'm a morning writer. So my process is changing a little bit, and certainly writing with someone else is a whole new experience. And I love my son, and I'm really glad we're doing this. But boy, oh boy, I am a solitary worker. Most writers are.
Yeah.
And so I'm having to change a lot. And it's not easy, but it's good for me.
I was going to because I think it should be this. No, I think it should be that. Right?
Yeah, and he's really good at things I'm not so good at, and vice versa. So we make a good team. But it is a learning curve. There's this very steep learning curve.
Wolf Hollow was when you started writing in first person. Mm-hmm. So how has that changed your focus or process?
Changed everything. Yeah. I can't believe I was 55 years old before I wrote anything in the first person. What was wrong with me? I mean, I'm a big advocate of taking risks and trying new things. I should have followed my own advice and done that sooner, because writing in the first person allows for such intimacy with your character. It allows you to see the world so have such focus on what's happening, because you're seeing everything through her eyes, that it's really helped me to be a better writer. So I wish I'd started sooner, but can't reverse time. So going forward, I may try something different down the road just to see where that takes me. But for now, I'm very happy with that perspective.
I mentioned you work with students and your books have been used by teachers as study guides. So what do you think about that?
look, I'm gobsmacked about all of this. I just, you know, when I wrote Wolf Hollow, I thought, you know, maybe this will get published. But I just, and I had a feeling that maybe I would continue to, you know, write and maybe publish for the rest of my life. But my life has changed radically since that book was published. All kinds of opportunities have opened up for me. And it's all been an incredible combination of good fortune and great opportunity and a lot of hard work. I can't even remember the question that prompted this, but
about the study, using
oh, right.
your books as
so
study
the
guides.
Idea yeah. that kids are reading my books in the first place, that that teachers are teaching my books in the first place, all of that is just fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's amazing, and I'm still surprised about it.
Yeah. So you mentioned that most of your books take place in the past, not current. But do you purposely take issues from current times to weave into your stories?
Never. I always start with setting. Then I add one character, and then I see where she goes and with the other characters who join her in the story. And then the story comes last. So as I write, I start to notice patterns and themes emerging, and I develop them. But I don't set out, I don't say, I'm going to write a book now about bullies or loneliness or whatever. Those are the things that rise.
Mm-hmm. You know, artists, when they're painting, sometimes it's like that painting never gets finished, right? There's mm-hmm. always something you want to change. And you're talking about you've got these characters and they're going off in these directions. How do you ever bring all of that together? Okay, I'm going to lose this and this, and we're, you know, and is it really done? Like you said, that, you know, the industry moves like molasses, and you've got these books sitting there. Do you go back and go, well, maybe I'll just change a little of this or that?
That's a good question. Usually I finish a draft before I start to rethink any of it. Then I let it rest for a while, and then I go back and I rewrite it and make changes. And then I send it to my agent and editor, because at that point, I usually could use another set of eyes. And I have friends who read my early drafts and suggest things. But I have a very good relationship with my editor. We don't always see eye to eye, but her eye is very good.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's good to have a good editor,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. So I mentioned you also write poetry. And now you're talking about a screenplay. These are like very different ways of writing. Where does that inspiration come from with the poetry? And how do you change those hats?
The poetry, I haven't written a lot of poetry lately because I'm so involved in prose, but I have to get back to it because poetry makes me a better prose writer. It's like a scalpel. You know, every word matters so much in a poem. The right words in the right order never applies more than when you're writing poetry. And that makes me a more disciplined and also a more poetic prose writer. And I like merging the poetry and the prose very much. Screenplays are such a different animal that as I'm learning how to write one, I'm realizing that a good movie truly is an adaptation of a novel. They're really different, very, very different. And the process of writing one is very, very different. So poetry hasn't yet really informed that process, but it definitely, definitely is closely linked to prose for me.
Yeah. Were there, I'm just thinking surprises. You talk about you'll kind of let the characters go where they will without giving away anything in this book. Were there something you later went back, wow, I wasn't expecting that?
Always. Always. And yeah, I can't give away the things. The things that really, really surprised me the most came out of thin air. One is something that happens to a character named Ruth in the first book. It happened as I was writing it. And I was like, holy cow, what is going on? And it was very important to the plot of the book. So yeah, I think on a subconscious level, I'm figuring things out faster than on a conscious level. Things are suggesting themselves to me. But a lot of it is being open to the universe and to any influence that comes along. And you learn after a while to recognize the things that belong in what you're doing.
Do you pay attention to reviews? You've had great reviews on your books, but is that something that you pay attention to, or are you just kind of like...
I pay attention to them, but I try not to pay too much attention to them or to let them influence me, good or bad, because that gives you monkey mind. You know, it's like as you're writing, you don't think about whether it's going to make money, whether it's going to be made into a movie, whether it's even going to be published, whether the people are going to like it, what the reviews will be, because those are all distractions you don't need. Just focus on the work itself. So after it's published, yes, I read reviews, But I don't read Goodreads. I don't read Amazon reviews. People will give you one star because they got a paper cut from the paper. Those things drive me mad. But also, it's a subjective thing. We're not all supposed to like the same things.
Right.
So it's just fine with me if people don't like my work. But I'm glad to hear it when they do.
Yeah. So what are you working on now?
I'm working on, well, I wrote another book during the pandemic, which is Resting, and I'll go back and rewrite. And now I'm halfway through a new book set in Western Mass on the Connecticut River about a girl named Hannah. And I'm working on some other projects that have very little to do with writing, but more with art. So I've got a lot of irons in the fire.
So these are the book, you have one that's written, one that's half done, and they're completely, these aren't sequels to anything, they're just completely different stories.
They are, but I have to say, every kid I meet goes, when are we going to get a sequel for Beyond the Bright Sea? And and they've pretty much mapped it out for me, and they've done the same with Echo Mountain. Kids have completely mapped out the sequel. They've told me exactly what they want. And I have to unlearn that information. I don't want to be influenced by it, but they're pretty smart.
Yeah.
So I always say, why don't you write that book?
Oh,
go ahead and you write that.
Yeah, inspired. So you talked about how a lot of this is inspired by your mom's family and your time on the farm. Did you get confused on what really happened and what you made up?
I do all the time. In fact, I was giving a talk yesterday and my mother was there as looking at me, and I thought, am I getting this right? Because I do forget which things I've made up and which are truth and which are half truth. It's all blended together, which I love doing. It's the best recipe of all for me. But I often have trouble distinguishing fact from fiction.
Lauren Welk's new book is My Own Lightning. We'll have a link with more information about it at our website, capeandislands.org. And of course, you'll be at the Centerville Library at 5:30
today.
This afternoon.
Correct.
Yeah. And more things coming up, right?
More things coming up.
On the venue website.
June, July. I will post them as we nail down dates. But the rest are Zooms or are off Cape.
All right. More on young adult books after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing young adult books and how to keep teens engaged with reading. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. According to 2021 data from the National Literacy Trust, the most popular reading choice for children and young people is text messaging, followed by in-game communications. Despite the allure of technology, one in two young people reported they do read fiction on paper in their free time, while nearly 3 in 10 reported reading fiction on a screen. But data also shows that enjoyment of reading wanes as children enter the teen years. Over 60% of 8 to 11-year-olds said they enjoy reading, whereas just 48% of 14 to 16-year-olds said the same. As enjoyment of reading falls off and competition from technology grows, how can we engage teens and young adults in reading? Joining us is Meg Crona, young adult librarian at the Falmouth Public Library. Welcome, Meg.
Hello. I'm happy to be here.
So you came up with this brilliant idea to keep teens engaged, a series of young adult author interviews moderated by students for students. Where'd that idea come from?
Right. I think originally it came from, I was speaking with Sarah, who does events at Eight Cousins downtown Falmouth Bookstore, and she, as many bookstores do, was talking about getting authors to come in and do book talks, and it occurred to me that, wow, what an incredible thing. And I think we might have a teen audience. They might be into that. So we gave it a try.
And it's been popular, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, our first one was yesterday with Tiffany Jackson. She's phenomenal. And it went really well. We didn't have a ton of people there, but everyone who came was thrilled to be there. She was wonderful. We had a student moderator who did a phenomenal job. We have 4 more coming up throughout the month. So we're very excited.
What is the young adult age range when we're talking about YA books? What are we talking about?
So, I mean, pretty much 7th through 12th grade, 13 to 19. I mean, there are soft edges on either side, but about that.
Tell us more about the authors on the roster of talks that you have coming up and why you wanted to include them.
Okay. Well, they're all just incredible. Like I said, we started with Tiffany Jackson yesterday. And then next we have Laurie Halls Anderson, who's probably most known for writing Speak. She's got several other books. Shout is her newer memoir that's out recently. Then we have Brendan Kiley, who wrote the other talk. He also co-wrote with Jason Reynolds, All American Boys, and he's had several other books as well. Then we have Kristen Terrell, who's a sci-fi writer. also has new books out. All of these authors have books that are fairly new out, very popular. So I know that they're, you know, within the YA community, well-known authors. And then last, we have Candace Elo, who's a non-binary author. And they have... their first book was Everybody Looking, which is written in verse. And we were speaking about that earlier, about the kind of the melding of prose and poetry. And I love novels written in verse. So that was their first one. And then their second book is being published actually like in the neighborhood of right now, maybe this week, called Break This House. Mm. So, I mean, I'm thrilled. All of the authors are just so interesting. Their work is so, covers so many timely important topics that I think it's just going to be a great opportunity for great conversation.
When something is well written, readers can feel an emotional connection to the characters. What's the impact on young readers when they can talk with the author of that kind of a book?
Gosh, man, books are so powerful and important to readers of all ages, but I think especially as a teenager, kind of coming of age, kind of figuring out who you are and working through all kinds of different issues. Authors and novel, the stories just are so powerful. And I think the opportunity to speak with someone who created something that had an impact on your life is, I mean, it's great. So it's so interesting and what a great opportunity.
Mm. Lauren, I want to ask you that question because you get that work with some of the students you talk with are really emotionally connected to some of your characters.
Yeah, they kids really, when they love a book, they really, really love a book. You remember what that's like.
Of course.
I remember reading Charlotte's Web and being changed forever. And so being able to meet the author is nice, but to ask questions and have conversations with the author is very, very important to them. And lots of times these are budding writers themselves, and mm-hmm. so they feel encouraged when they get to meet a writer and talk about process and talk about how writing has changed the author's life. It's all good.
And what did you mean by that?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Go deeper, right?
Yeah.
So, Meg, how do you find the student moderators for the talks?
Oh, well, just in throughout the course of promoting it and on social media and everywhere else, I've been emailing every English teacher essentially in the area, every school librarian. And at the end of the email, I always put, and if you know a student who may be interested in being the moderator, please direct them to me. And so really that's, and we've actually, since we're talking about it, I've still got two student moderator positions open. So
what ages are you? I mean, what would be the ages of the moderator?
Any teen, 13 teen? To 19. Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, ideally someone who may have read the book, but also, like I've said to other people, sometimes students might be interested in journalism or in just kind of, yeah, they might be interested in asking the questions for asking the question's sake, really. Mm-hmm. And so that's okay with me, too. You know, I really just, you know, I think it's important to have a student do it. I like the idea of this question's coming from a student, but I also like the people who are listening, the other students, to be like, hey, that's my friend asking that question. Right. You know, it just kind of feels like it's, you know, for them. By them.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. So are the, we talked about there are adults who read
Absolutely.
YA. So are the talks open to all, even adults?
Absolutely, 100%. We're happy to have anyone. And actually, it's interesting. We asked Tiffany Jackson yesterday, like, what is the difference for you between a YA book and an adult book? And, you know, is there value in reading a YA book as an adult? And she had something really interesting to say. She said, yeah, absolutely, there's a lot of value in reading a YA as an adult. And she said something like, I'm paraphrasing, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm just kind of repeating senior year in high school over and over again, just working through those same issues kind of. And as you get older, if you read something as an adult, a YA book, you might have the opportunity to kind of readdress, reprocess, and work through some of the issues. And you might be able to kind of tie some things in a bow for yourself and move on, you know, more fully. And I think that's lovely.
Yeah. Books for young adults can address some weighty topics, as we were talking about earlier, sexuality, racism, assault, trauma.
Absolutely.
Some young adult readers may have firsthand experience with these issues. For others, it may be the first time they're learning about it. Mm-hmm. How are YA authors writing about these topics for this audience?
Ooh, well, it's so important, I think, to kind of take the stigma away, especially I'm thinking of Speak and sexual assault and writing about it in such a way so as to remove any shame. And I think say, you know, that can be said for lots of other kind of weighty issues. I'm not sure. I mean, not being not a writer, I don't know that I can speak too much to how they're doing it. But the effect, I think, is to encourage conversation and to, you know, encourage growth and a thoughtful conversation. So, yes, they are kind of heavy topics, but they're always addressed in such a thoughtful way and encourage conversation. And, you know, it's just, it's so important.
All right. You're not an author, but we have a YA author right here. What are your thoughts on that, Lauren?
When readers see themselves in a book, everything changes. And so if authors are writing about their own experiences or experiences with which they have a lot of experience secondhand, and they've done their research properly, which is incredibly important with topics like these, so they get it right by some definition, and it rings true on the page, then kids who with whom that will resonate feel such validation and such encouragement. And kids who haven't had those experiences themselves learn so much in a new way that it's very, very important. And I think it's a great responsibility on YA authors who are dealing with issues like that to make sure they do get it right.
Yeah.
Because they're authorities.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Meg, do you recommend parents read YA books before suggesting them to their teens?
I don't know if that's... I recommend they read YA books, period. But I don't know that it's necessary before suggest them to their teens. There's there are librarians that can suggest books. Mm-hmm. And also, certainly, there are other ways of getting suggestions. I guess I just wouldn't put any fences up for students.
Well, and librarians and bookstore owners. I mean,
absolutely.
I know with nieces and nephews that are a certain age, I'll go in and say, you know, what do I know what like an 11-year-old girl might want to read? And she's not into X, Y, and Z, but she likes, and they always, every time, hit it right on the mark, right?
Right, right.
They've read these books. You've read them. So what should parents, educators, and librarians be doing to help teens and young adults as they read books that address some of these more complicated issues? I guess you're talking about having thoughtful conversations. Maybe how do we start that, I guess?
Gosh.
Besides having, you know, attending your series, right?
Right. Well, actually, it's a great way to start because you can ask the author, you know, what their intention was and what their thought process was. I think as long as parents, teachers, you know, when students are reading heavy, difficult things, I do think it's important for them to ideally have someone to process it with, to talk about it with in a thoughtful way. So I really think just being kind of aware of what the young people in your life are reading and being open to having conversations about it. And yeah, it's certainly your conversations could be fuller if you had also read the book. So that's great. I don't know that it's necessary all the time. Gosh, this is as not a parent, this is hard for me to give advice to. I would never dream of doing that. So I think just being available is the most important thing.
I say, Lauren, you're a parent. I'm just saying the same thing. You know, you can tell when something sparks your kid's interest in what they're reading, and they come and they want to talk about it, right?
Yeah, and depending on the age, they may not come to you.
Right, that's true.
But to make the information available, I mean, if there's a book about suicide and kids who are in danger of feeling suicidal, read that book. There ought to be available to them in an immediate way phone numbers and websites where they can go to find out more information and to get help if they need it. They'll go to their friends. Their friends, when you're a teenager, your friends are your primary source for support and information. And so, but regardless, all that information should be made available through schools and everywhere else at all times to kids so that they have everything they need.
And, you know, I have a 7-year-old grandson, and he last week asked me, do you think it's true that there's more trillium in space than on Earth? And I was like, so we looked it up together and found out, yes, indeed, because this was something he, I guess, read in one of his Wildcrat books. And, you know, so yes, it is. So if anybody asks, yes, it's true.
Now I am.
The classic YA fiction includes Catcher in the Rye, To Kill a Mockingbird, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. How do these books compare with what's being written for teens and young adults today, do you think? And classics are always the classics.
Classics,
right?
Are the classics, and I love them too. There are... It's a difficult question because there is an argument to be made to appreciate the classics, but move on because there are some problematic elements in some classic books. Some white savior stuff going on mm-hmm. in To Kill a Mockingbird, for example, some things that we can do better. Nice. So while I certainly appreciate the classics, to read YA books written by people of color, written by the global majority, or sometimes mm-hmm. we say minorities in this country, to hear it from their perspective, from their voices, is just so important. And like I said, the classics are wonderful, but there's so many incredible books out there available now that are perhaps a little bit less problematic in some ways.
Yeah. All right, so we're hearing more and more about schools and states banning certain books. What do you hear from young people about book bans? And do you as a librarian have concerns about this renewed enthusiasm of banning books?
You know, it's funny. In some ways, I think banning a book is the best way to get a kid to read it.
I was thinking the same thing, right?
So,
what is it?
Yeah. You know, and I'll say this. I was recently in Portland, Oregon at a library conference, and prior to going there, I wasn't terribly concerned about book banning, you know, especially in public libraries. To their credit, they're always on the front lines of anti-censorship and always kind of on the right side there. But having left after Portland, I became much more concerned with book banning in schools, and it really is troubling and scary. It was in the news recently that Brooklyn Public Library is offering free e-cards to any teenager anywhere in the country as part of an effort to combat against this book banning in schools. And I think it's an opportunity and obligation for public libraries to step up and be there when, you know, should that happen in our communities and in any community, to make sure that we have the books there and they're available and we'll yeah. always have them.
Yeah, and as you were saying, if it's banned, I mean, that just piques the curiosity, right?
Absolutely.
So you got a kid going, wait a minute, I want to. It's almost like you could have a section in the library, but banned books.
We absolutely
oh, you do
sometimes. Yeah, well, we have, there's banned books week, so we always get all the banned books out then. But really, at any time, it's almost like a list of things you should read. That's how I look at it. If anything's been banned, well, I better read that and figure out why.
Yeah. What do you think about that, banning books, Lauren?
Well, of course, it's completely wrong. when I was a teacher for 4 years only as a full-time English teacher, I was given the task of creating my own curriculum, and I picked books that I thought would be amazing for 11th graders. And just by chance, I picked among the most censored and banned books at the time. one of them was Huck Finn,
mm-hmm. Oh my!
For heaven's sake. Beloved was on my list, Slaughterhouse-Five, Fahrenheit 451, all these really interesting, well-written books that were cutting-edge books. And I got pushback from some parents about Beloved by Toni Morrison.
Wow.
And I can't say why on air because it was vile.
Yeah.
But I can say that we need to fight, and fight some more to prevent banning.
Yeah. Meg, we talked about that a lot of teenagers, you know, they kind of drop off of the reading. So if you're a parent and you got a teenager like, oh, I want to try to get my kid. I mean, Harry Potter was great for that, right?
Yeah.
What advice do you have for a parent to put that book in your child's hand that might get them reading?
I always, when people say they don't like reading, I always feel like, well, you haven't found the right thing. You haven't read the right thing yet. This may not be the most popular opinion, but I think graphic novels can be absolutely phenomenal. They can be just as rich thematically and as far as character development goes as a traditional novel. And for some students, maybe struggling readers, mm-hmm. maybe just kind of a little bit reluctant and like the visual element or like the art part of it, it can be a good... I've read just some phenomenal graphic novels, and that might be a stepping stone. I also think... just try and find the right book. And mm-hmm. librarians and teachers are so happy to talk books and help. You know, what is the student like in general? We can work with that and figure
and
out what might be a good pick, you know?
Yeah. Once that magic hits, right?
Right.
Can I suggest, too, when mm-hmm. I was a high school teacher, I read to my students a lot. And I sometimes would, their homework was just to read in class and then continue on at home. Reading to kids and reading to, you'd love to be read to, don't
sure,
you?
Sure, yeah, of course, yeah.
Read to them. They'll get hooked on the books that way.
The Young Adult Author Interview Series at the Falmouth Public Library is happening every Tuesday evening in May. And since it's on Zoom, it's available wherever you live. But registration is required. We'll post a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Meg Crone, Young Adult Librarian at Falmouth Public Library and organizer of the event. Thanks for being here. Thanks for doing it.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Lauren Wolk, author of My Own Lightning. Thank you, Lauren.
Thanks for having me, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.